The eLife Podcast from eLife, the open access journal for outstanding research in the life and biomedical sciences, online at elifesciences.org.
Hello and Merry Christmas. This is episode 96 of eLife's podcast. I'm Chris Smith from The Naked Scientists. In this episode, the desert decomposition conundrum, how things can break down so quickly in the dry. What worms can reveal about a gene linked to autism, and how mice decode the smell of cats. But first, every year, influenza circulates globally, evolving and adapting as it goes, and its arrival in most given geographies usually coincides seasonally with winter time. Now, this steady evolution changes the face that the virus presents to our immune systems, and it's what enables it to stay one step ahead of us and to keep on coming back. So for a vaccine strategy to work, scientists have to try to anticipate sufficiently far ahead what forms of the virus are going to emerge in any forthcoming season to give healthcare systems enough time to mass produce and then administer an appropriate vaccine cocktail that can protect a population. We get it right about 60% of the time. So why is that number not 100%? Where are the shortcomings in the system? And what's it going to take to push up, assuming we can, our hit rate? This is what Richard Neer at the University of Basel, where he works on predictive models of flu, has been wondering. He's hoping to shed some light on where the weaknesses are and how surmountable they may or may not be.
We know that influenza viruses adapt very rapidly to human immunity, meaning they mutate such that antibodies don't recognize the virus as well anymore as they used to. And these variants that have these immune escape mutations, these adaptive mutations, that tend to increase in frequency. And our primary means of predicting future population would be that you look at the ones that grow in frequency and extrapolate this frequency growth further into the future. But it turned out that many things that grow at some point stop growing and then just meander about. This sort of curious growth is what triggered this work.
Is that because it grows and turns itself into a mutational disaster? Or is it because it grows, flourishes, but then we catch up? Our immune response catches up and heads it off. So then it's kind of stuck.
Yeah, we believe it is the latter. So as these viruses grow in frequency and circulate, whoever gets infected by them generates immunity against them. So in a way, they are using up the susceptible populations that allows them to circulate, and thereby their growth advantage ends up being diminished as their frequency increases.
Why do they not, though, just stay one step ahead of us continuously and just keep on changing so that they can continue to grow and we're always playing catch up?
To some extent, they do, but sometimes you have a mutation that endows a virus with a particular advantage, but from there it's stuck in a place where it can't really go further, but some other viral lineages that also circulate, they tend to have gone a different path in mutational space that offers them more future opportunities to further adapt. So there is sort of a way in which viruses can back themselves into a corner, and while they have a transient advantage, then they're sort of stuck in a place, while other ones that were initially not as successful then overtake them.
There are obviously lots of different families and types of virus. Many of them share some characteristics with flu, but they are different from the flu. We've just been through a pandemic caused by a different group of viruses, the coronaviruses, but they seem to show a very similar pattern to the one you're describing, where we saw jumps of the virus to adopt a new configuration. It thrived in that form for a bit, and then a new one came along, and then it got as far as the Omicron variant, and it seems to have stalled there, and we're getting lots of offshoots of that, but we haven't seen these dramatic shifts again. So is COVID showing a very similar pattern to the mechanism you think is at play with flu?
Yeah, COVID is a very, very interesting example. You know, the main difference with COVID is none of us had seen COVID 5 years ago. Now we have all gone through multiple exposures, multiple times being vaccinated or infected. While flu has been around as long as we've been living, and people that have been born in different decades have been exposed to different flu histories in a way. They've seen different flu viruses throughout their life, and thereby have more diversity in their immunological makeup. We believe that these differences in this immunological makeup affect the virus host co-evolution. And that for if you have a very heterogeneous immunological makeup, there's lots of sort of different niches that some viruses can exploit and others can't. While in the more homogeneous case with COVID, it's more likely that you have one variant that escapes a larger fraction of the population and thereby has a growth advantage that carries it through the entire population and it ends up wiping out all other variants.
With things like the flu, then, if you can now work out mechanistically what is going on, does this mean we are in a stronger position to make predictions about the future and therefore make better judgments about the sorts of vaccines that we're compiling to try and head off what the virus is going to do as it goes through the population?
I certainly hope so. I think the main insight from this work is actually exploring the limits of predictability. What aspects of a future population are predictable, which ones aren't, and how much faith should be put into this kind of predictions versus another kind of prediction. So this eco-evolutionary dynamics that we see inherently limits the prediction horizon, if you wish, so that the amount of time we can run these predictions forward is limited by the sort of intricate interaction between host and virus.
How far ahead do you think we can look then? Because obviously people are in lots of other laboratories and rival groups to your own. They're spending a fortune trying to answer this very question. They're bringing AI in to look at past flu behaviour, future flu behaviour and so on. Are you saying then that in fact we're going to have to narrow our horizon?
Well, there's certainly a lot of molecular features that we've discovered over the last decades. So mutations in particular places, changes in the viral protein. These are features that often make a virus successful. And I think these predictions are going to get better and better. This is absolutely crucial for this vaccine optimization, vaccine selection process. And then there is sort of another question as to how confidently can we predict the relative proportions of different variants 3 months out, 6 months out, 12 months out. And that's sort of where the main insight from our work here is, that prediction of these explicit measures of population makeup of the future, these are going to be much, much harder. Currently, it's sort of one season that over which these predictions can be meaningfully made. But making now sort of actually frequency predictions for the next winter season, the 2025-26 winter, that currently I don't think is in reach. And sort of our paper here highlights some sort of intrinsic limitations that predictions of this kind face.
If we know what the limitations are, though, we understand something about the mechanism of those limitations, which means we might be in a position to do something about it. So does your paper also shed some light on where we need to direct our efforts to try to become better at doing this in the future?
Yes. So, my take home from this work is that to actually make those predictions better, we need a much more fine-grained understanding of what immune systems of what part of the population recognize which viruses how well. So we would want to be able to measure this kind of immunological makeup for, children and teenagers and adults and older adults and the elderly in different parts of the world, so that we really kind of understand if there's a new virus coming in, sort of who is how susceptible to this new virus and who is protected from this virus. That will allow us to understand the future frequency or trajectory of the virus for some time, and it also might help us to identify variants that are of particular concern because vulnerable groups are less well protected than they should be.
So a little way to go, but we do at least now have a handle on where most of the gaps are that we need to address. Richard Neer there. Planet Earth is a giant nutrient recycling machine. Energy from the sun captured by photosynthesis feeds a food chain of consumers which, when they die, are recycled by an army of decomposers that release the nutrients and embodied energy back into the environment for reuse. And hitherto, much of the attention around these decomposers has quite appropriately focused on microbes, bacteria and fungi. These thrive in warm, wet environments. So, unsurprisingly, the wetter it is, the faster things tend to be broken down. But there's a catch. In extremely dry places, where the normal assemblage of microbial recyclers ought to struggle, decomposition nevertheless proceeds at the same expected rate. so something must be stepping in to fill that gap, but no one knew what. Now, Nevo Segui, working originally at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem and now at the University of Texas at Austin, thinks he may have solved what has been dubbed the desert decomposition conundrum.
This is a question that exists for about 50 years already. What we know is that decomposition or the breakdown of plant litter is determined by the activity of microorganisms such as bacteria or fungi, and they are very much moisture dependent. So we expect that decomposition should increase with moisture availability. But the problem is that in dry lands, which is like the dry part of the world, it is more than 40% of the global land area, this model doesn't work. Decomposition doesn't increase with annual precipitation.
So if I drew a graph of the rate of decomposition on the y-axis and the amount of moisture in the soil on the x-axis, what you're saying is we should see an upward sloping line. As it gets wetter, the decomposition should go faster. But what we actually see is almost a straight line between the dry and the wet. So it doesn't follow the prediction of wetter equals faster breakdown.
Yeah, I would just comment here that this is the case in dry lands. So basically, most of the research is done in the most wetter ecosystems, like temperate ecosystems. But dry lands, which are less studied, just show very different trends.
So something is changing. When it's dry, something must be stepping in to compensate to keep up the rate of decomposition, because the normal mechanism is not doing what it would normally do. There has to be something filling the gap.
Exactly. And this is what was termed the dryland decomposition conundrum. And it stimulated much research that basically what people asked is, what is different between drylands and this other wetter ecosystems? And there are several mechanisms that were tested, but all of them were mostly focused on the role of microbes or the other things that facilitate the activity of microbes. And what we offer here is a different hypothesis, basically some other organisms, larger organisms, are more adapted or activity under very dry conditions. And maybe they can kind of compensate for the lack of microbial decomposition. And this is why we see same decomposition rate across different precipitation levels.
How did you test that hypothesis then?
What we did is a multi-site decomposition experiment. We went to seven different sites across a gradient of precipitation. We did this litter box experiment. We have this box or cage where we keep plant litter, and we allow different sizes of organism to access this litter. So we have three different treatments. One was just allowing microorganisms to access the litter. The other allowed also mesofauna. And the third treatment allowed the whole decomposer community, which also includes the macrofauna, which we believe has the more important effect in drier sites.
Right. So basically what you're able to say is, well, if we allow different categories of decomposer in and they vary by size, if they are filling the gap in the dry place and we exclude them, we should see that desert decomposition gap come back if we exclude the big guys and they're responsible.
Exactly. You are just right. To look if the mechanism we suggest is right, we also use pitfall traps just to capture ground active insects. And we use this to really characterize the macro decomposer community or assemblage in these different sites. And we repeated this experiment in the winter, which is cool and wet, then in the summer, which is hot and very dry.
What did it show? Have you got to the bottom of the desert decomposition conundrum? Do we think what you have done shows that it is the bigger consumers that move in and fill the gap?
Yes, so what we have found is very beautiful, because in the winter we saw that microbes dominated decomposition in general, and that decomposition increased with precipitation. But in the summer, what we saw is that macro decomposers were the dominant decomposers, and the decomposition in general peaked in the, we call it the arid sites. And when you look at the two seasons combined and the total decomposition, you really see comparable decomposition rates across the gradient. Actually, well, one of the arid sites, total decomposition was higher than the wetter sites.
Well, congratulations on solving a 50-year-old mystery. And apart from being extremely satisfying academically, why does this matter?
Drylands cover more than 40% of the global land area. So this is kind of a big deal. It means that we should look at different sizes of decomposers and treat them separately when we do, for example, carbon cycle models, when we want to understand how trajectories of carbon cycling and then of ecosystem in the world in general are going to change in the future, because we do see desertification. We see these trends, and therefore, I think this is very crucial.
Nevo Sigi there. This is the eLife podcast from The Naked Scientists. I'm Chris Smith. In a moment, how mice detect and respond to the smell of cats. But first, a gene called P10 has been linked to a number of neurodevelopmental and behavioural disorders, including autism. In some cases, it seems to affect the relative proportion of inhibitory and excitatory nerve cell populations. How exactly changes to P10 cause these presentations, and whether we can use this knowledge to ameliorate them, we don't know. But now, working with C. elegans worms, which also use this same gene in their nervous systems, Argentina's UNS researcher Diego Rashes has made an intriguing observation. Mutating the worm equivalent of P10 produces an imbalance of inhibitory and excitatory neuron numbers. But giving the animals the substance beta-hydroxybutyrate, which is a chemical known as a ketone body and produced naturally by our own metabolisms when we burn fat, can reverse the effect of the mutation.
In recent years, there is several reports that link mutations in a specific gene called P10 with neurodevelopmental defects, for instance, autism. This gene is present not only in humans, but throughout the animal kingdom, even in very simple multicellular animals like worms. In autism, there is an imbalance between excitation and inhibition. So we wanted to see what is the relationship between this gene and the imbalance between excitatory and inhibitory genes.
So given that you've said that this gene is present throughout the animal kingdom, even in worms, does that mean then you could study a worm and look at some of the same changes that are in the genes in humans with things like autism, put those changes into a worm and ask, does the worm's nervous system change as well?
Yes, that was the idea. Given that the activity of P10 is very well conserved and it has more or less the same function throughout the animal kingdom, and in worms we can manipulate very easily in the laboratory, we wanted to study this relationship between P10 and excitatory and inhibitory neurons to try to understand what happened.
And when you do this, if you look at the manipulations of that gene, is it reflected in changes in the balance of excitatory and inhibitory neurons in the worm brain like it is in the human brain?
Yes. What we observe is that animals that this gene is not working has specific impairment in the development and in the morphology of the GABAergic neurons. The GABAergic neurons are the inhibitory ones. while the excitatory neurons are quite normal. They are not affected. So there is too much excitation in this animal.
And is there any way to revert that? Is there any intervention? Because obviously we've got to have an eye on if we wanted to apply this knowledge in neurodevelopmental disorders. Is there anything we could potentially do to rebalance things?
Yes, the first achievement of this work is that we have now a kind of paradigm where to study the relationship between P10 and this imbalance between excitation and inhibition, and we can try now different interventions to try to ameliorate that. We tried one of these interventions when we exposed the animal to a ketone body. Ketone body is a metabolite that we produce when we are fasted, and we found that the presence of this ketone body ameliorates the specific defects on GABAergic inhibitory signals, ameliorating this imbalance, so the animals are more normal, even though they have the mutation in P10.
Just to clarify then, are you saying that when you feed or expose the animals to this ketone body that we naturally make when we're starving, that it resets the balance of activation and inhibition in the nervous system? Is that because it changes the nerve populations, or does it just change nerve function? And does it only do that when the ketone body is there, or does it change it developmentally thereafter?
We found that there is a specific time window when the ketone body is efficient. So it is important that the ketone body is present when the neurons are being developed. If we just expose the animals when they are adults to ketone body, the ketone body do nothing. What we found is the ketone body acts when the neurons are developing, and somehow the ketone body acts very early in development, preventing the developmental defects that we do see in P10 mutant.
Do you have any insights into how it might be doing that? Because it's quite a bizarre observation that this naturally present chemical could shift brain development so dramatically. Is it signaling in some way? Is it triggering some other genes to get switched on to compensate in these animals? Do you know how it might be doing this?
In mutations in P10, there is an inhibition of a transcription factor. So there are a lot of genes that are not being expressed. And this probably arises for the defects that we do see in P10 mutants. The exposure of this animal to the ketone body enhances the activity of this transcription factor. Therefore, we think that rescue the expression of some important genes for the inhibitory neuron development.
I know this is a very speculative question, and you haven't looked at this per se, and certainly not in anything bigger than a worm, but there will be circumstances where a pregnant animal, including a pregnant human, may well be exposed to chemicals like ketone bodies. Women will be starving at certain points. They may have really serious morning sickness, so they just can't eat, for example, and that could do this. Do you think then that this is happening during development in, say, mammals, and could be affecting the development of the nervous system?
For sure, during pregnancy, there is an increased levels of ketone body, even in mothers that are eating normally, right? So maybe endogenous ketone bodies are playing a role in neurodevelopment, and maybe enhancing this effect of the ketone body in neurodevelopment, let's put it this way. It would be good to evaluate in mammals, if increasing the levels of ketone body, to see if there is an improvement in the neurodevelopment of P10 mutants in mice, for instance.
It's an intriguing finding, isn't it? Diego Rasch is there. Mice are genuinely fearful of cats, and when they encounter the aroma of a feline, they freeze and then they scarper. This happens thanks to an accessory smell system called the vomeronasal organ, or VMO. One of its roles is to detect pheromones, and its wiring into the limbic system enables it to coordinate mating behaviour. But it can also, as it turns out, detect predator smells, including cats, and projections to the brain's hypothalamus can then initiate defensive responses. Interestingly, the extent of these responses isn't binary. They're proportional to the intensity of the stimulus. Sachiko Hagayamanaka from the University of California, Riverside, has used cat tears, which contain odorants that the mouse VMO is sensitive to unpick the neurological pathways responsible.
What we are looking at is interspecies communications. The vomeronasal organ, or VNO, can detect chemical cues from predator species in prey animals. So what we are looking at is how the predators can control the behavior of the prey animals.
Where is the vomeronasal organ located?
The vomeronasal organ is situated within the nasal cavity, between the nasal cavity and oral cavity.
Is it therefore anatomically distinct from the bits of the olfactory system that smell
yes.
other smells? For instance,
yes.
if I bury my nose in a bunch of flowers, if I were a mouse and I was sniffing flowers, I would smell the flower scent with one part of my system, but I would smell uh-huh. other things with this vomeronasal organ. It's a separate entity from the rest of the olfactory system.
Yeah, exactly. The vomeronasal organ is sensory organ of the accessory olfactory system. And then the main smell is detected through the main olfactory system.
And how is it wired up? What's it connected to? And what supplies the innovation to carry signals from it and to where?
The vomeronasal organ contains sensory neurons, and then the axons of the sensory neurons travel to the frontal part of the brain called the accessory olfactory bulb. And then from there, send the signal to the amygdala or the hypothalamus that controls innate behaviors such as mating or defensive behavior.
How did you use that understanding then to test whether or not it could detect, for instance, the smell and presence of a potential predator?
First of all, we looked at the behavior to the source of the predator cues. In our case, cat saliva was used as a predator cue source. And then we looked at the behavior changes. At the same time, we also looked at whether the sensory neurons in the vomeronasal organ was activated or not using a specific neural activity marker called the CFOS.
Right. So in other words, you can present the cat saliva, which mm-hmm. you hypothesize the mouse can smell and be alarmed by. And you're looking mm-hmm. to see if when that is present, the nerves that connect between the vomeronasal organ and relevant mm-hmm. brain target structures, whether they change their activity, which would argue they are sensing the smell of the cat's saliva.
Yes.
So that tells you they're sensitive to it, but how do you probe what it does to their behavior?
What we looked at was freezing behavior. The freezing is one type of the defensive behavior response.
So if I present some yeah. of the particular odor to the mouse, it will uh-huh. freeze when it smells it. That's what you're saying, isn't it? It will suddenly lock
yes.
up.
Lock up, yes.
Once you'd establish that scent is detected and it's going to these different brain areas, how did you then try to establish how the response is programmed?
The specific population of the neurons in the hypothalamus are activated by cat saliva exposure. And then the activation controls the freezing behavior output.
And is it a proportional response? So if I had a big dollop of cat saliva, would I get a bigger response, or is it a binary thing? It's all or nothing.
Yeah, we tested that regular amount of the cat saliva and the diluted cat saliva. The non-diluted cat saliva induce robust behavior, but diluted, like almost diminished freezing behavior response.
So it does mean that the animals can make a proportionate response to a varying concentration of the potential threat stimulus from the environment.
Exactly.
What have yeah. we learned then? If you could sum up, if you were to sort of give us a summary of what this study adds or how this changes our understanding, what do you think mm-hmm. you've done to move the field forward with this?
What we found was that predator cue contains a time-sensitive component that influences the intensity of the defensive behavior output. And then the VNO can detect such time-sensitive chemical cues. and then the moderate the intensity of the behavior through the VNO mediated neural circuitry. The ventromedial hypothalamus is involved in this circuitry and regulates defensive behavior output.
Sachiko Hagayamanaka there. Well, that's where we're going to have to leave it for this episode, and in fact, this year. You have been listening to the eLife podcast, which is produced by The Naked Scientists. Previous editions, the references and the full text transcripts for these programmes, as well as details on how you can subscribe to this podcast, are at nakedscientist.com/eLife. The Naked Scientists also publish a weekly science programme which covers the latest leading science stories, and you can find that over at nakedscientist.com/podcast. I'll be back in 2025 with another look inside eLife. Until then, from me, Chris Smith, thank you for listening. Have a wonderful Christmas and a very happy new year. And I'll see you on the other side. Goodbye.
The eLife podcast from eLife, the open access journal for outstanding research in the life and biomedical sciences. Online at elifesciences.org.